This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the last weekend, a murder suspect became a murder victim, and the two killings became a national story because the first was a cop, Corporal Richard Findlay, hit by a truck and dragged to a horrible death on a highway in Prince George's County, Maryland, and the second was his alleged killer, 19-year-old Ronnie White, who was choked to death in a solitary confinement cell in the county jail. The only people with access to that cell were corrections officers and prison officials, and several of them initially refused to cooperate with investigators. Another factor. Corporal Findlay was white and Ronnie White, African-American, in a county where racial tensions run high and police have repeatedly been accused of both excess force and racial profiling. It's hardly the first time that law enforcement officers, men and women who depend on witnesses to come forward and name names, have themselves fallen silent when one of their own may be accused. Our main focus this hour is on the blue wall of silence. If you've served as a police officer or a corrections officer, we'd be especially interested to hear from you today. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, poetic justice. Teenagers who vandalized Robert Frost's summer house sentenced to study his poetry. We'll talk with their professor. But first, the Findlay White case. And we start with Aaron Davis, the Washington Post's lead reporter covering the story. He joins us from studios at the Washington Post. Nice to have you with us on the program today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Aaron, at this point, what do we know about Ronnie White's final hours in solitary?
Well, there still is a little bit of a mystery. Quite a mystery. Over the last 20 minutes window that we know of, Ronnie White was seen at 10:15 by a guard making his last check before lunch. 10:15, he was checked by a guard. At 10:35, another guard came through with his lunch to put it through the slot in the door, and there was no answer at the door. They opened the door and found him slumped, unresponsive, with no pulse, no detectable pulse, on the floor of his cell.
And is there a camera trained on that cell?
There's no camera trained on that cell. There's no cameras trained inside the maximum security unit. There are cameras in the hallways leading to that unit so that someone, a guard who is in the maximum security booth controlling that area, can see who's at the door before he lets them in. But there's no cameras in that area. There are, from what we understand, other inmates, based on the relationship of their cells to where Ronnie White should have been held, who may have been able to see the front of one Ronnie White's cell. And there should have been a maximum security booth guard and at least two other guards in that immediate area during that time.
And as I understand it from your story this morning, according to sources, the only people with access, you need a key card to get into the cell, and the only people with that key card, there's only about a dozen.
We understand that the Maryland State Police and the FBI, who are both investigating, have been first focused on interviewing more than a dozen guards working that Sunday morning who had key card access to the maximum security unit. We don't know the entire universe of people who could have had access, but we know that those are the first that investigators are looking at.
And so they're focusing on the corrections officers.
They are. County Executive Jack Johnson was clear off the bat on Tuesday night when he held a press conference releasing the findings that they were first focused on anyone who had access. When pressed about whether or not other inmates could have had access and could have done this, they said they were just focusing on those, on specifically seven guards at that point that they knew of who had key card access.
And the story reports that several of the corrections officers declined to cooperate, at least at first.
They did. As we understand it, in the first day, the investigation really took a very slow start. Several of the guards contacted both at the jail and then, as investigators and detectives went to their homes, declined to comment. There's a little bit of unclarity about how and why they chose not to cooperate off the bat. We do know that since then, some have. We know that they initially received guidance from their union not to talk, or at least not to say anything incriminating. We know that at least one has also used language of declaring his Fifth Amendment right not to speak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And at this point, you say the investigation is in the hands of the not the Prince George's County Police, but the state police in Maryland and the FBI.
Exactly. Once it became clear Monday night that the medical examiner had made a preliminary finding of homicide, It was turned over to the Maryland State Police, which do investigate all in-custody deaths in prisons, state prisons in Maryland. And the FBI also opened a civil rights probe into White's death at the request of county officials. Prior to that, initially on Sunday, when White just was found slumped on his floor and then was pronounced dead an hour later at a Prince George's County hospital, Prince George's County Police themselves were brought in to conduct a death investigation.
We're talking with Aaron Davis of the Washington Post. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Ken's with us on the line from Cincinnati in Ohio.
Hi, I'm embarrassed to say that I think you just answered the question because you had initially said he was just found slumped over, yet your answer said he was choked to death. But the forensics now supports that, right?
Best we know, the medical examiner came back a day after he was found and said, to their best understanding, that he had two broken bones in the front of his neck, which are consistent with asphyxiation, strangulation, asphyxiation. We don't know if there was some device used for that or if hands, medical examiners, medical experts we've spoken with say those injuries are consistent with someone either being choked, strangled by hand, or possibly by the weight of a foot.
Gotcha. Well, thank you for clarifying that. It also just seems that that's almost common in our correctional nationwide, the system that of violence within prisons or something. Just there's an incredible amount of it. And I was wondering, can you comment on that also, aside from the specific case?
Well, every jail has its own issues. Here in Prince George's, there is a record in the past year of one guard was arrested on charges that he had supplied cell phones to inmates. He was also alleged to have been a member of the Blood Street Gang. Other inmates showed up with keys to handcuffs in their possession. One of the guards was arrested on assault charges in another county. And ultimately, earlier this month, the head of this particular correction center was fired after four guns were missing from the jail's armory.
Your story did also point out that two other suspects involved in killings of police officers were in that same facility, and they did fine.
Right. I mean, to be fair, this is a mystery to a lot of people, and a lot of the guards, and early on when the guard union was making statements about this before their lawyers instructed them not to, they said, we have a hard time believing this was one of ours. There have been other alleged suspects who have allegedly killed police officers, not necessarily county police officers in the line of duty in Prince George's, but lots of times they transfer inmates from other counties to counties outside of where the crime allegedly happened so that there's a little bit of a buffer there. And there were, yes, other inmates who have been in that prison who are alleged cop killers and have, made it through fine.
And to broaden Ken's point, let's bring in Laura Sullivan, NPR's police and prisons correspondent. In 2006, she reported in an award-winning three-part series on life in solitary confinement. You can find a link to that series on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Laura Sullivan with us here in Studio 3A. So how much of this goes on nationwide, Laura?
The violence in prison in terms of attacks by inmates on inmates and attacks of guards on inmates has risen dramatically over the past couple of decades. But when you look at the actual homicide numbers of how many inmates are killed in prison, and this doesn't include people who fall ill or commit suicide, there are about 20 people every year over the past 5 years have been murdered in prison, in jails. There are about 50 people who are murdered in state prisons. The vast majority of those are killed by other inmates. It is very rare to have correctional officers charged with murder of an inmate. What you sometimes see happen, however, and there have been a couple cases of this nationwide, where an officer will ask another inmate to provide favors for an inmate to kill another inmate. But these numbers have remained flat over the past 5 years. They were a lot higher in 1980. They dipped dramatically, and now they're starting to increase again.
Hmm. Ken, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, sure.
And let's see if we can go now to, this is Dan. Dan's with us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I just wanted to point out something really quick that many people may not know about police and correctional officers as relates to the Fifth Amendment. Police and correctional officers are unlike people in the general populace, are have a Fifth Amendment right, but can be forced to waive that right, essentially, or else they'll lose their job if there's a formal investigation. And a lot of officers, when faced with that, will invoke what, or will wait to be wait for the Garrity rule to be invoked.
And what's that?
The Garrity rule basically is a rule that applies only to police and correctional officers, wherein any testimony they may give in an official investigation can't be used against them criminally. And just as a matter of course, many police unions will advise their members not to speak initially until they are provided with that Garrity protection.
Immunized, effectively. Dan, you speak from experience?
Not direct experience, but I work as a union rep and I'm a little more familiar with them than most people may be.
And Aaron Davis, is that the situation? Could that situation have arisen in Prince George's County?
We are hearing pieces of that. Certainly police officers who are involved in police shootings, they are first put on administrative leave, and they do have a 10-day period in which they, before they are required to provide a statement, and many take that time to sit back, recollect, and put together their statement. On the correctional officer side, there isn't the equivalent for correction officers, but if they are giving a statement in the process of an administrative inquiry, that is very different than a statement in the process of a criminal inquiry. And there are different rules depending on which contract they fall under. And this, there are specifics here with the contract of the Prince George's County Correctional Officers.
Thanks very much for the call, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Aaron Davis, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Aaron Davis, a Washington Post Metro reporter who's been covering the case in Prince George's County where an alleged cop killer was murdered, evidently, in a solitary confinement cell. And we're talking today about the blue wall of silence and the difficulties that some police and corrections officers have in telling the stories. These are officers, police officers particularly, who depend on witnesses to come forward to make their cases. And, well, is there a double standard? I'm Neil Conan. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, especially if you're a police or corrections officer. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the case of Ronnie White and Officer Richard Finley. Began as a local story here in the Washington area, so for those who are not familiar with it, the facts are these. 19-year-old Ronnie Wright arrested on Saturday, charged with running over and killing Corporal Richard Finley, a police Prince George's County, Maryland police officer. While in solitary confinement in the county jail, Ronnie White was murdered. He died of asphyxiation. The only people who should have had access to his cell were prison guards and prison staff. Some of them, at least initially, did not talk with investigators. We still don't know who killed Ronnie White, but many people are already jumping to conclusions. In a case like this, perception can be everything. So, today, we want to hear from corrections and police officers about the blue wall of silence and when to come forward and when not. And we'd also like to know from the rest of you, if you knew that Ronnie White was, in fact, guilty of killing a police officer, would that change things? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can also check out the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Laura Sullivan, still with us. She's the police and prisons correspondent here at NPR News, and she reported the three-part series on life in solitary confinement. And before we go further, Laura, solitary confinement, we imagine some sort of a dungeon. What does it actually mean?
You basically have a concrete room that's about 8 feet by 6 feet wide. It has a concrete bed, a stainless steel sink, a stainless steel toilet, and that's about it. You spend 23 hours a day in there in most states. Every state has different rules, but you come out for 1 hour in an exercise pen where you get maybe a small little look at the sky above. And you come out of your cell to shower, but that means usually that you come out and you walk about 20 feet. You eat, you sleep, you breathe inside this cell all day long, every day.
And who's in there? Are these high-profile alleged cop killers, or are these people causing trouble in the rest of the jail?
In the majority of solitary confinement prisons across the country, it's gang members. That's largely where this whole buildup of solitary confinement has come from. However, you obviously have terrorists in the federal prison system, and you have high-profile people like this particular suspect. if they are suspected of killing a police officer or a correctional officer, they are automatically put into solitary confinement. Prison officials call it segregation.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Laura. Laura with us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Yes, like I say, I've been a correctional officer for the last 10 years, and at the beginning of the program, everybody that wanted to speak about us called us guards. It's one of those negative connotations the public has about us. As far as the blue wall of silence goes, I believe a lot of that comes from the public is so quick to jump to the wrong impression about what goes on inside of a prison that they always, you know, it's always negative, you know, so we would rather talk to the people in charge and not have the first thing we say come out of our mouth taken wrong.
So you wanted to wait for an attorney to talk to somebody to know what your rights are, to get think it through?
Not necessarily an attorney. You know, we want to speak to the prison officials, the correct police department. You know, we don't want the first things that we say to be taken wrong, because people are quick to jump and believe that we are in the wrong without knowing the facts first.
And in this case, we don't know the facts, and we don't want to jump to conclusions. And Laura, if I was one of those people who used the word guards as opposed to corrections officers, I apologize.
Well, I say we spend a lot of time in training, and we are law enforcement officers, but we're rarely treated that way.
Laura, amplify on this, if you would.
This is something that this issue of officer versus guard has come up in the past, maybe about the past 5-10 years or so. It's very important to people who work inside prisons to be called correctional officers, because as one correctional officer told me, they're not standing guard, they're not standing watch. They think that's sort of an archaic 1950s kind of mentality, that what they do now is supposed to be rehabilitation. They are correcting behavior, and it's far more involved these days than it is just standing watch.
And dangerous too.
Very dangerous. The levels of assault on officers in prisons, if you take California alone, have doubled in the past 10 years just on officers. And that's a result of the type of inmates that are in prison and mostly the overcrowding that is happening in the majority of states.
Laura, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
David
Klinger teaches in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. He used to be a police officer in the Los Angeles Police Department. He joins us now from the studios of KWMU, our member station in St. Louis, Missouri. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me again.
Is there a special protocol within a police department when a police officer is killed?
Well, the protocol would typically be the investigative protocol, to do everything that we can to identify who the perpetrator or perpetrators were so that we can take them into custody as quickly as possible. One of the things that people sometimes don't think about is that if an individual is willing to kill a police officer, then he's probably, or she, probably willing to kill anybody. And so cop killers are people that are very dangerous, and that's one reason why the police want to get them into custody as soon as possible.
Yet that might be a difficult situation. How do police officers control their emotions when they're dealing with somebody who they may believe very strongly just killed one of their colleagues?
I think the biggest thing is professionalism and training. And law enforcement officers all around the country who are properly trained understand the presumption of innocence. Even if they saw with their own eyes their partner officer murdered, they have an obligation to take the individual into custody with whatever level of force is appropriate. Unfortunately, for suspects who murder police officers with some frequency, they end up getting killed by other officers. However, it must be also pointed out that about 75% of all cop killers are arrested without the police using lethal force against them, and they stand trial.
This, again, I'm taking from the Washington Post, obviously, heavily covering the story, is from a column today by Mark Fisher. In a nationwide poll of police by the National Institute of Justice, 61% said officers, quote, do not always report even serious violations by fellow officers. And 67% said whistleblowers were likely to be, quote, given the cold shoulder. Do those statistics make sense to you?
I don't quite understand them in the context of dealing with an individual who has just murdered a police officer, or is that just in general?
No, just in general, yeah.
I think that those type of statistics do make sense. Without full context, I couldn't tell you exactly what they're talking about because I don't know how the survey was put together. But yes, police officers are human beings like everybody else, and if an individual does something wrong, while it should be reported, oftentimes the police officer who saw something doesn't really know exactly what happens. They want to find out themselves precisely what happened before they go forward and make any sort of report to anybody.
Did you experience that phenomenon that we call the blue wall of silence, where officers declined to speak about an incident involving another officer?
Actually, no. It was quite fascinating. When I was a young police officer, came out of college, and my instructors had told me about the blue wall of silence and so on and so forth. And when I was on the streets of Los Angeles and then Redmond, Washington, I found a high level of professionalism, and police officers did, in fact, turn fellow officers in when there was a serious violation. Some minor things, absolutely. Police officers will look the other way if there's some minor breach of protocol. But so far as criminal violations, any time someone that I knew of was involved in something illegal, they were reported by a fellow officer.
Laura, is that your impression too, that Internal Affairs is not known as the rat squad?
I think, especially in prisons, there's a daily dynamic of us versus them. And when you and I even find it when I'm reporting stories that if you spend too much time talking to inmates, and some of the officers feel that you have betrayed their trust, or and the other way around as well. So when an incident happens in a prison, there is often a sense of not talking until the lawyer or the union rep arrives, that they stick together as a group and that they don't rat each other out.
Let's get a caller on the line. Danny with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hey, I appreciate you taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I was a police officer for 15 years. I was on SWAT team, and I was an instructor in North Carolina. And what your guest has said is absolutely correct. On minor things, most officers, in my experience and in my time on patrol, would look the other way for minor step-outs, from policy or from procedures. But the big things... But now I have to disagree, though. I have seen, on numerous occasions where the larger things, you don't want to be the one that actually blew the whistle or reported it. But if you're called in, you're not going to, invoke your Fifth Amendment or anything or put up a wall because you don't want to be implicated in it. But, in the same sense, and I myself was guilty, on several occasions, I would not want to be the one, even though being aware and fully knowledgeable of something that's went on, because of the way my fellow officers would interpret my actions and would treat me, I just didn't want to be the one that actually blew the whistle.
As I understand it, Danny, you're drawing a distinction between initiating something, going to the commander or whatever, and saying, I'm here to report a problem that you may not be aware of, a distinction between that, and then if you are called in and people start asking you questions, that you see those as two different things.
Absolutely. I mean, and that may be a hypocritical point or object, perspective for it, but, you put on a weapon, you go to work every day, you risk your life, you leave your kids at 2 or 3 in the morning, and you think, I may not be home in the morning. I may not make it back. And those other guys do the same thing, and there's a very strong bond between you and them. And to just turn somebody in for something that, I wasn't in his shoes at the exact moment that the other officer committed whatever offense. And even though I may have been a witness to it, I don't know what stress level he had from that arrest or from that incident. And you just, you really hesitate to be the one to take the first step forward and not to take up too much of your time, but in my first years of my career, I was at a department in North Carolina where several officers were sent to federal prison. People I knew, fathers and the people who turned on them and testified were just looked upon as being the scum of the earth for sending those guys away.
Dave Klinger, that distinction that Danny's making, does that make sense to you?
Yes, I think another thing that it's important to draw a distinction about is police corruption and excessive use of force. And I think that the sorts of things that I'm talking about where officers that I know of would go ahead and turn another officer in would be if an officer went overboard with using too much force, or if an officer was involved in some corrupt practice where they were once again violating a felony statute, and some of these other things where it is policies and procedures. Did you fill this out right? Did you make sure that the scene was secured properly, so on and so forth? If someone fell down on one of those things because, you know, you can't do 100% job all the time, those are the sorts of things that we let go by the board, so to speak.
Danny, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you for taking it. And it's a very good show.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We're talking with Dave Klinger, professor of the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of St. Louis, University of Missouri, St. Louis, and with NPR's Laura Sullivan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Elliot on the line. Elliot with us from Oregon.
Yeah, I've been a deputy sheriff for about 7 years, and I agree with a lot of what the previous callers are saying in terms of there is definitely a level of looking the other way for minor things. And there's also that aspect of, you know, when major things happen, people are more than willing to step up. But I think part of the thing that people tend to forget is that they hold police officers, deputies, corrections officers to a higher standard. And most of the public kind of thinks of us as superheroes or expect us to be superheroes.
I'm sorry, Elliot, you still there? I guess we've lost Elliot's line. And my only response to that would be to ask Dave Klinger, aren't they expected to be held to a higher standard?
Sure, I think so. I think that we do need to ensure that police officers and correctional officers do the right thing and that they are held accountable. But the other thing that people have to understand, at least so far as the criminal justice system goes, that is criminal proceedings, police officers and correctional officers have all the same constitutional rights and whatever statutory rights in any particular state or under state constitution that any other citizen has. And so in that regard, they are to be judged in the same fashion, in the same form as any citizen.
Let's get Michael on the line. Michael from Salt Lake City.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say that my father was a correction officer for 15 years and still is today. And, you know, there are a lot of things that stories that are that you hear on the news and newspaper that are more negative. You don't hear the goods that they're doing in the prisons trying to you know, to rehabilitate and reinstitute these guys as you know, give them a chance to be members of society again. And the situation that happened, you know, there's a lot of things that could have happened, you know, and every day, you know, coming home, you know, he has to take off a hard shell that he has to put on and kind of desensitize himself from it all. So, you know, it's hard for a man to wake up and go to that and then come home and not say anything about it because he doesn't want his children or his family to know what really goes on. You know?
Now, Laura, that's a good point and a dominant feature, I think, of correctional officers' lives.
I think that the one of the statistics that I read said that correctional officers have a 20-year shorter lifespan than almost any other profession. And I think that's because on a daily basis, it is a very hard thing to do to walk into a place where you are so clearly outnumbered. And you have inmates who can spend all day long very creatively making weapons. And because of that sense of violence, they tend to bond together and band together. That's not to suggest, though, that there is not corruption in a lot of our nation's prisons.
And Michael, your dad, has this life been tough on him?
Well, you know, yeah. There are different kind of sort of jobs to do in a facility, and he's, you know, done just about every one of them. And yeah, it's hard to get on the positive side of it. So as far as aging, yeah, you know, it takes a toll on him because of that factor. It's hard for him to talk about those things and stories that he has talked to me about have blown my mind as far as, you know, what he does. So, yeah, it definitely takes a toll on a man and on a person's spirit.
Well, Michael, from us, I wish your father the best of luck.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for the phone call. And we'd like to thank our guest today as well, David Klinger, a professor of Department of the Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, with us from member station KWMU in St. Louis. And thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And Laura Sullivan with us here in Studio 3A. She's police and prisons correspondent for NPR News. As always, Laura, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up, call it poetic justice. The group of vandals who were sentenced to study poetry. Yes, the punishment did fit the crime. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow it's Science Friday, and Ira Flatow will be here. Much of the nuclear weapons industry is top secret, but there are parts of the atomic establishment that a tourist can see. Ira takes a trip on a nuclear family vacation, plus picking out science, technology, and environment-related tourist attractions in your neighborhood. That's all tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. Before his death in 1963, poet Robert Frost spent his summers at the Homer Noble Farm in Ripton, Vermont. Last December, a former Middlebury College employee broke in to hold a party there. Before it was over, 50 people showed up, many got drunk, and the house got trashed. Broken china, broken furniture, and carpet soiled with vomit and urine. 28 people, all but two of them teenagers, were charged with trespass and vandalism, and some of the guilty accepted an unusual plea agreement. They had to take a class on Robert Frost. Jay Perini, a professor of English and creative writing at Middlebury College, has been instructing some of these students in poetry and poetic justice. If you've ever been charged with vandalism, did the punishment fit your crime? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Jay Perini joins us from Middlebury College Studios in Vermont. He's also the author of Why Poetry Matters. And nice to have you on the program today.
Neil, thanks for having me on.
And I gather the original idea for this this sentence was from the prosecutor.
Yeah, I was just sitting at home one day, and I was, of course, like everybody in Middlebury, horrified when I heard that the Robert Frost house had been trashed. You know, I wrote Frost's biography 8 or 9 years ago. I'd worked on it for many years. And during some of those years, when I was writing that book, I actually spent the summers, part of the summers, staying at the Frost house. So the house meant a great deal to me, as it does to everybody that loves Frost and the people around here. I was horrified when the news broke that the place had been really trashed in a very bad way and that so many local kids had been involved in this terrible vandalism.
You say local kids? Were they college students or from—
No, they weren't. These were high school kids. These were, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids. A few of them, I think only two or three maybe, were like in their early 20s. They bought the booze. You know, they got the cans of beer. I think they turned up with 150 cans of beer. So this is just one wild teenage party that got out of control. And then the prosecutor called me. I was about to go play basketball with my pickup basketball buddies. And I get a call from the prosecutor's office saying he's talked this over with the judge. And he knew I was a Frost scholar and a poet. And he thought that the appropriate punishment for these kids, if you call it punishment, or reparations they could make for to the community, would be to come and study some poetry, Robert Frost specifically, with me. So he asked if I'd meet them, you know, in court diversion and instruct them in the poetry of Mr. Frost.
And obviously you agreed to do so. How did it go? What did you teach?
Well, you know, at first I was a bit hesitant. I wondered, is this appropriate punishment? My buddies on the basketball court, some of them collapsed in laughter on the floor. And I was skeptical at first.
Laughter at being forced well, sentenced to poetry.
The idea that that vandals would be sentenced to studying poetry. You know, some people pay good money to come hear me teach Frost at Middlebury College. And so it seemed rather peculiar. And, of course, it wasn't my choice. The judge and the prosecutor asked me if I would do this, and, you know, as a volunteer thing. And I thought, well, you know, they want me to try it. And I thought, what an interesting class to teach and a very pressured and sort of unique classroom situation. So I turned up, you know, wondering what on earth to teach. We planned two afternoon sessions. And I Xeroxed all different kinds of Frost poems, made multiple copies. There were 28 kids who agreed for court diversion that they would clear their criminal record if they would come and take this class on Robert Frost with me. A very unique punishment. Talk about the punishment fitting the crime, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, chose mainly to focus on the poem The Road Not Taken, partly because I assumed it's something that most high school kids in America will already know to some degree.
Two roads and diverged in a yellow wood. Yes, everybody
knows.
There
we go.
That
two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not, you know, travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood, and so forth. I recited the whole poem to them from memory. I think they were a little surprised that I actually had it memorized. And then I just sort of, as I would with any class, you know, but these kids, you know, I looked at them, you know, my heart sort of broke. I mean, I've got two boys that just finished high school. I've got another boy who's just in junior high school going into high school. And so these are like my own kids. And I felt really fatherly and protective toward them. You know, they're sitting there with their, you know, acne and their baseball hats turned on backward. There were four or five girls in the bunch, and they were literally, and some of them seemed a bit trembly. And it was a scary situation for them. You know, the prosecutor was sitting at the back of the room, and I was nervous too, wondering, you know, how can I use poetry to touch them in some way and make them at least, I thought, well, why am I doing this? I mean, what if they had broken into the house, say, of the plumber down the street? This would never be happening. But I said, you guys, in a way, were lucky. You broke into this treasure trove of wisdom. I said, think of it that way. And I told them about Frost's essay, Education by Poetry. It's a beautiful essay Robert Frost wrote. It's in his collected poems and essays. And he says, unless you're educated properly in metaphor, which is the essence of poetry, he says, you're not safe to be let loose in the world. And I said, you guys probably are not safe out there in the world quite yet. And I said, poetry might help you in some way. I said, you've got to understand metaphorical values, symbolic values. And so we talked about choices that we make in life. And actually, I found myself, as I was teaching this class, when I teach the class to my students at Middlebury, it's a, you know, sophisticated group, I do a fairly postmodern reading of the poem. Because Frost, it's a, you know, four stanzas, and in the first three stanzas, he tells us, look, these roads are lying there. They're the same. Both that morning equally lay. In leaves no step had trodden black. So nobody's gone this way, left, or right. And then he ends the poem, I shall be telling this with a sigh. Somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood. And I took the road less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Now, in a postmodern reading of that poem, it's more complicated. Why does he spend the first three stanzas telling us that these roads are the same? And both that morning equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden black. And then he tells us at the end, he took the road less traveled by.
Yeah,
but there's that crucial sigh in there. And that sigh, I always tell my classes, that's the most pregnant sigh, crucial, painful sigh in English American literature. Because Frost is recognizing that when he's an older man and he sits with his grandchildren around his knee, he's going to say, I'm your grandpappy, the famous poet Robert Frost, four Pulitzer Prizes. I've been on the cover of Time magazine. I, you know, spoke at the Kennedy inaugural. And yet, I'm going to tell you, I took the road less traveled by. I became a poet. I marched to the beat of a different drummer, went my own way. And I'm going to know in my heart of hearts that I'm lying, that, in fact, we can't tell when we come to roads which way is the road taken, not taken, traveled, less traveled.
And let's see if we can get some listeners involved in this conversation. Again, our number is 800-989-8255. And our guest is Jay Perini, a professor of English and creative writing at Middlebury College in Vermont. Roger's on the line. Roger's with us from Cleveland.
Hey, hi, guys. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
We're just fine.
I'm just calling in with a brief little note about a punishment I administered to my son one time when he and his young buddies, teenage buddies, ran amok in the neighborhood. And his punishment was to read Lord of the Flies and then sit down and discuss it with me afterwards.
So a literary punishment again.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of effective, too. I think he learned something from it, as opposed to getting grumpy and irritated with me for some other type of mean punishment. I think I gave him something to do, and he learned something about that kind of behavior and you know, the crowd behavior.
I remember that book. Aren't you afraid that he might have picked up some tips?
He picked up the what?
Picked up some tips.
Yeah, he might have burned your house down.
Well, fortunately, he didn't. I think it made some slight improvement in his behavior, although it did not cure him of being a teenager.
No, only time will do that.
Yeah, only time does that.
Thanks very much for the call, Roger.
Okay.
As a parent, you know, I think you're right. As I said, I'm a parent of three boys, and finding the right punishment for a crime is very hard. And I think America is an extremely punitive society. I think our punishments are often really harsh, really out of bounds with the crime. And here these kids, you know, had a wild party that went wrong. They did some very bad things up there. As you know, they soiled the place. They mm-hmm. burned part of it. They trashed some furniture. Nevertheless, I always tell people that poetry is about restoration. You know, poetry is about reparation and restoration, healing people. It heals the soul in a certain way. That's what I, you know, tried to argue. And why it was kind of interesting. I just spent years working on this book, Why Poetry Matters, and making all these, you know, pronouncements about how poetry can actually help people live their lives.
Now you're asked to put it into practical application.
Then a prosecutor calls and says, hey, listen, you want to try this thing out? Hmm. And I was, you know, handed a gift, really. It was wonderful.
Let's get David on the line. David with us from Sedona, Arizona.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, David.
Good. This really brings up a memory for me when I was just graduated from high school back in New Jersey, Middlesex, New Jersey, but 1 month prior to the age of 18, the age of majority. A friend of mine came over my house one evening when my parents were out and informed me that in an empty lot about a block from my house that I wasn't aware of was a grave. It turned out it was the original settling family for that area. We went down there, and in our youthful exuberance, read that as teenage boy, no brain, we decided that it would be great to have the headstones. So we dug down and not only dug up the headstones, but went further and dug up the grave, at which point the houses next door decided it was time to call the police, and I was arrested along with my friend and charged with grave robbing.
And what?
Bit of a challenge. What's that?
I was just going to ask what the sentence was.
Well, the sentence was to do research on the original family that lived there and then return the grave to its condition and tend it for 6 months.
Huh.
So
wow.
I got an education in genealogy, history, landscaping, and personal responsibility.
I might have sentenced you to read Frankenstein, but...
And have you been robbing graves since is the question.
No, I've cut back on my diet.
David, thanks very much, and it's nice to hear a rehabilitated case.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Jay Perini about some students, some kids, teenagers, not students, high school students in Middlebury, Vermont, who vandalized the house that Robert Frost used for many years to write poetry. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get John on the line. John with us from Spokane in Washington.
Yes, gentlemen, thank you very much. This is a wonderful, wonderful program.
Thank you.
Hey, great.
My issue was very simple. I forgot to shut the door, and my grandmother, this is 65 years ago, was very upset with the fact that living in Minnesota, if you leave the door open in the winter, the house never quite warms up. So she had me memorize a poem, and it was the wonderful poem called Godfrey Gordon Gustopher Gore, never remember to shut the door. His mother would yell, his father implore, Godfrey Gordon Gustopher Gore, you must remember to shut the door, et cetera, et cetera. In any event, it had its effect, and I learned to shut the door, and I have shared that with my children and with my grandchildren. And I think what you did was absolutely magnificent, and again.
Well, thanks. It's nice that poetry was involved. Your grandmother thought of poetry as a way out for you.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The irony, of course, is that I've written a couple thousand poems since, so it had a good...
There you go.
And you remembered that one.
Absolutely.
Well, John, do you still write poetry?
I absolutely do, yes. Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for that. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So long.
Bye-bye.
And let me ask you, Jay Perini, as you were teaching these kids, Two Roads Diverged in Yellow Wood, not the postmodern reading that you were giving it to your college class, what reading did you give it to them?
Well, I really, at first it flashed in my head. I'm so used to giving that kind of fancy postmodern reading. But I realized these kids are at a very simple level here, and Frost is confronting one of the issues that we have moral choices breaking in front of us at every moment. And I said, look, kids, you're in a dark wood. You are literally and figuratively here in your life in a very dark place. And these kids were scared. They had been arrested. They could have gone to jail. They could have done some real time in jail. In fact, their older counterparts had to go to jail for 72 hours for this, for bringing the booze. And so I said, this is a dark place in your life, and now might be the moment to start thinking about the choices you made that day, going to that party, what you did at that party. I started questioning them. I said to this one little guy, he had his hat, baseball hat turned on backward, and he looked like his lips were trembling. And I said to him, any thoughts about this poem? And he said, I guess I took the wrong road, didn't I? And I said, you did. You took the wrong road that night. But I said, you know, the good news is that you're always in the woods in life, and there's always going to be paths, forks in the road. And I said, you've got the opportunity in front of you now to take a different path.
Hmm.
And I said, everybody, we're all doing this. The rest of your life, you're going to be in dark woods again and again. Two roads are going to diverge in that wood, and you're going to have to make a choice this way or that way. And I said, just be reflective about the choices you make. Think about them. And I said, what maturity and adulthood are about is somehow understanding the choices we made, coming to terms with them, maybe putting a spin on them, but also understanding that until the second we're dead, we're making choices. That's what life is about.
Let's get Jack on the line. Jack with us from Wake Forest in North Carolina.
I have a story about what you all were talking about crimes and punishments fitting.
Go ahead.
Last summer, I was over in Ireland, and my parents were on vacation for 2 weeks, leaving my brother, who'd just come back for the summer from college, home alone. And he and his friends spent basically 2 weeks just partying it up at my house and pretty much vandalized almost everything there.
I saw that picture. Risky business, yes. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Back,
the movie.
They
yes.
decided that they were going to have him, rather than, you know, taking away stuff, they had him do all the consulting work. They had him hire everybody to fix the house.
And do you think it got through to your brother in an important way?
Oh, yeah. He hadn't had anybody over to the house since.
Well, I don't think they wanted him to be a monk, necessarily.
Oh, no. He showed a lot more responsibility in the last year. He hadn't wrecked anything, and he's always owned up to his stuff now.
Well, thanks very much, and we're glad your brother is rehabilitated, too.
Thank you.
And Jay Perini, we just have a couple of seconds left, but yeah. Do you think your students got it?
Well, let's say I'm sure they'll never break into the Robert Frost house again. It's hard to know. Obviously, I can't tell. One can never tell as a teacher what effect you're really having on the student. You can plant seeds. You can make suggestions. You can try to communicate to them that poetry is, in a sense, a life or death matter, and that it is going to affect the rest of their life if they can understand these things for the better. But, when I finally left teaching them and I walked away and I saw them in the parking lot of the community building where we were, going into their parents' cars and stuff, you know, I could just hope that that they'd been lifted and given a clear path into the future.
Jay Perini, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Jay Perini, professor of English and creative writing at Middlebury College in Vermont, also the author of Why Poetry Matters, with us today from the studio at Middlebury College. Ira Flatow's here tomorrow with Science Friday. I'm on vacation next week. Guy Raz and Ted Koppel will fill this spot. Give the newcomer a break. Have a safe, happy 4th of July. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.